as if she'd spent most of yesterday doing the granddaddy of all workouts, rowing machine, treadmill, stairmaster, although the only exercise she had taken was her walk with Bill, and that had been no more than a leisurely stroll. The sound was like the trains in Grand Central Station, she thought. What sound? For a moment, she thought she almost had it, had something, anyway, and then it was gone again. She got slowly and cautiously to her feet, stood beside the bed for a moment, then walked toward the bathroom, limped toward the bathroom. Her right leg felt as if she had actually strained it somehow, and her kidneys ached. What in God's name? She remembered reading somewhere that people sometimes ran in their sleep. Perhaps that was what she had been doing. Perhaps the jumble of dreams she couldn't quite remember had been so horrible that she'd actually made an effort to run away from them. She stopped in the bathroom doorway and looked back at her bed. The ground sheet was rumpled, but not twisted or tangled or pulled loose, as she would have expected if she had been really active in her sleep. Rosie saw one thing she didn't like much, however. Something that flashed her back to the bad old days with terrible and unexpected suddenness. Blood. They were the prints of thin lines rather than drops, however, and they were too far down to have come from a punched nose or a split lip. Unless, of course, her sleeping movements had been so vigorous she'd actually turned around in her bed. Her next thought was that she'd had a visit from the Cardinal. This was how her mother had insisted Rosie speak of her menstrual periods, if she had to speak of them at all. But it was entirely the wrong time of the month for that. Is it your time, girl? Is the moon full for you? What? She asked the empty room. What about the moon? Again, something wavered, almost held, and then floated away before she could grasp it. She looked down at herself, and one mystery was solved at least. She had a scratch on her upper right thigh, quite a nasty one from the look. That was undoubtedly where the blood on the sheet had come from. Did I scratch myself in my sleep? Is that what... This time, the thought which came into her mind held a little longer, perhaps because it wasn't a thought at all, but an image. She saw a naked woman, herself, edging carefully sideways along a path which was overgrown with thorn bushes. As she turned on the shower and held one hand under the spray to test the temperature, she found herself wondering if you could bleed spontaneously in a dream, if the dream was vivid enough, sort of like those people who bled from their hands and feet on Good Friday. Stigmata? Are you saying that on top of everything else you're suffering stigmata? I'm not saying anything because I don't know anything, she answered herself, and how true that was. She supposed she could believe, just about barely, that a scratch might appear spontaneously on a sleeping person's skin, matching a scratch that was occurring at that same moment in the person's dream. It was a stretch, but not entirely out of the question. What was out of the question was the idea that a sleeping person could make the nightgown disappear right off her body simply by dreaming she was naked.
Take off that thing you're wearing.
I can't do that. I don't have anything on underneath.
I won't tell if you won't.
Phantom voices. One she recognized as her own, but the other. It didn't matter. Surely it didn't. She had taken her nightgown off in her sleep, that was all, or perhaps in a brief waking interlude which she now remembered no better than her weird dreams about running around in the dark or using white stepping stones to cross streams of black water. She had taken it off, and when she got around to looking, she would no doubt find it wadded up under the bed. Right, unless I ate it or some... She pulled back the hand which had been testing the water and looked at it curiously. There were fading reddish-purple stains on the tips of her fingers, and a slightly brighter residue of the same stuff under her nails. She raised the hand slowly to her face, and a voice deep down in her mind, not the voice of Practical Sensible this time, at least she didn't think so, responded with unmistakable alarm.
Dasn't put that hand that touches the seeds into your mouth. Dasn't. Dasn't.
What seeds? Rosie asked, frightened. She smelled her fingers and caught just a ghost of an aroma, a smell that reminded her of baking and sweet-cooked sugar.
What seeds? What happened last night? Is it...
She made herself stop there. She knew what she had been about to say, but didn't want to hear the question actually articulated, hanging in the air like unfinished business.
Is it still happening?
She got into the shower, adjusted the water until it was as hot as she could take it, and then grabbed the soap. She washed her hands with particular care, scrubbed them until she could not see so much as a trace of that rose madder stain, even under her nails. Then she washed her hair, beginning to vocalize as she did so. Kurt had suggested nursery rhymes in different keys and vocal registers, and that was what she did, keeping her voice low so as not to disturb the people above or below her. When she got out 5 minutes later and dried off, her body was starting to feel a little more like real flesh, and a little less like something constructed out of barbed wire and broken glass. Her voice had almost returned to normal as well. She started to put on jeans and a t-shirt, remembered that Rob Lefferts was taking her to lunch, and put on a new skirt instead. Then she sat down in front of the mirror to plait her hair. It was slow going because her back, shoulders, and upper arms were also stiff. Hot water had improved the situation, but not entirely cured it. Yes, it was a good-sized baby for its age, she thought, so absorbed in getting the plait just right that what she was thinking did not even really register. But as she was finishing, she looked into the mirror which reflected the room behind her and saw something which widened her eyes. The morning's other, more minor discordancies slipped from her mind in an instant.
"Oh, my God,"
Rosie said in a strengthless little voice. She got up and walked across the room on legs which felt as nerveless as stilts. In most regards, the picture was just the same. The blonde woman still stood on top of the hill with her plaited hair hanging down between her shoulder blades and her left arm raised. But now the hand shading her eyes made sense, because the thunderheads which had overhung the scene were gone. The sky above the woman in the short gown was the faded blue denim of a humid day in July. A few dark birds which hadn't been there before circled in that sky, but Rosie hardly noticed them. "The sky's blue because the storm is over," she thought. "It ended while I was, well, while I was somewhere else." All she could remember for sure about that somewhere else was that it had been dark and scary. That was enough. She didn't want to remember any more, and she thought maybe she didn't want to have her picture reframed after all. She knew she had changed her mind about showing it to Bill tomorrow, or even mentioning it. It would be bad if he saw the change from overcast and thunderheads to hazy sunshine, yes, but it would be even worse if he saw no change at all. That would mean she was losing her mind. "I'm not sure I want the damn thing anymore at all," she thought. "It's scary. Do you want to hear something really hilarious? I think it might be haunted." She picked the unframed canvas up, holding the edges with her palms, denying her conscious mind access to the thought, "Careful, Rosie, don't fall in," that caused her to handle it that way. There was a tiny closet to the right of the door leading out into the hall, with nothing in it yet but the low-top sneakers she'd been wearing when she left Norman, and a new sweater made out of some cheap synthetic stuff. She had to put the picture down in order to open the door. She could have tucked it under her arm long enough to free one hand, of course, but somehow didn't like to do that. And when she picked it up again, she paused, looking fixedly at it. The sun was out, definitely new, and there were big black birds circling in the sky above the temple. Probably new, but wasn't there something else as well? Some other change? She thought so, and she thought she wasn't seeing it because it wasn't an addition, but a deletion. Something was gone. Something... "I don't want to know," Rosie told herself brusquely. "I don't even want to think about it. So there." Yes, so there. But she was sorry to feel the way she did because she'd begun by thinking of the picture as her personal good luck charm, a kind of rabbit's foot. And of one thing there was absolutely no doubt. It was thinking of Rose Madder, standing there so fearlessly on top of her hill, that had pulled her through on her first day in the recording studio when she'd suffered the panic attack. So she didn't want to be having these unpleasant feelings about the picture, and most assuredly didn't want to be afraid of it. But she was. After all, the weather in oil paintings usually didn't clear up overnight, and the amount of stuff you could see in them usually didn't grow and contract, as if some unseen projectionist were switching back and forth between lenses. She didn't know what she was going to do with the picture in the long run, but she knew where it was going to spend today and the coming weekend, in the closet, keeping her old sneaks company. She put it in there, propped it against the wall, resisting an urge to turn it around so it would also face the wall, and then closed the door. With that done, she slipped into her only good blouse, took her purse, and left the room. As she walked down the long, dingy corridor leading to the stairs, two words whispered up from the very bottom of her mind. I repay. She stopped at the head of the stairs, shivering so violently she almost dropped her purse, and for a moment her right leg ached almost all the way up to her buttock, as if she had been struck with a savage cramp. Then it passed, and she went quickly down to the first floor. I won't think about it, she told herself as she walked down the street to the bus stop. I don't have to if I don't want to, and I most definitely don't want to. I'll think about Bill instead. Bill and his motorcycle. Thinking about Bill got her to work and into the dark-toned world of Kill All My Tomorrows without a hitch, and at lunch there was even less time to think of the woman in the painting. Mr. Lefferts took her to a tiny Italian place called Della Famina, the nicest restaurant Rosie had ever been in, and while she was eating her melon, he offered her what he called a more solid business arrangement. He proposed signing her to a contract which would pay her $800 a week for 20 weeks or 12 books, whichever came first. It wasn't the $1,000 a week Rhoda had urged her to hold out for, but Robbie also promised to put her together with an agent who would set her up with as many radio spots as she wanted. You can make $22,000 by the end of the year, Rose. More, if you want it. But why knock yourself out? She asked him if she could have the weekend to think about it. Mr. Lefferts told her she certainly could. Before he left her in the lobby of the Corn Building, Rhoda and Kurt were sitting on a bench by the elevator, gossiping like a couple of thieves. He held his hand out to her. She returned the gesture, expecting her hand to be shaken. Instead, he took it in both of his, bowed, and kissed it. The gesture, no one had ever kissed her hand before, although she had seen it done in lots of movies, sent a shiver up her back. It was only as she sat in the recording booth, watching Kurt thread up a fresh reel in the other room, that her thoughts returned to the picture which was now safely, you hope, Rosie, you hope, stashed away in her closet. Suddenly she knew what the other change had been, what had been subtracted from the picture. The armlet. The woman in the rose-madder chiton had been wearing it above her right elbow. This morning, her arm had been bare all the way to her shapely shoulder. When she got back to her room that night, Rosie dropped to her knees and peered beneath her unmade bed. The gold armlet lay all the way in the back, standing on edge in the dark and gleaming softly. To Rosie, it looked like the wedding ring of a giantess. Something else lay beside it, a small folded square of blue cloth. She found a piece of her missing nightgown after all, it seemed. There were reddish-purple spatters on it. These looked like blood, but Rosie knew they weren't. They were the spill of fruits, better not tasted. She had scrubbed similar stains off her fingers this morning in the shower. The armlet was extremely heavy, a pound at least, perhaps even two. If it was made of the stuff it looked like it was made of, how much might it be worth? $12,000? $15,000? Not bad, considering it had somehow come out of a painting she'd gotten by trading away a nearly worthless engagement ring. Still, she didn't like to touch it, and she put it on the night table beside the lamp. She held the little packet of blue cotton in her hand for a moment, sitting there like a teenager with her back propped against the bed and her feet crossed, and then she unfolded one side. She saw three seeds, three little seeds. And as Rosie looked at them with hopeless and unreasoning horror, those merciless words recurred, clanging in her head like iron bells. I repay. Picnickers.
Norman had been trolling for her. He lay awake late in his hotel room on Thursday night and across midnight's dark knife edge into Friday morning. He turned off all the lights except for the fluorescent bar over the bathroom sink. It threw a diffuse glow across the room that he liked. It made him think of the way streetlights looked when you saw them through a heavy mist. He lay almost exactly as Rosie had lain before falling asleep on that same Thursday night, only with just one hand under his pillow instead of both. He needed the other to smoke with and to convey the bottle of Glenlivet standing on the floor to his lips. "Where are you, Rosie?" he asked the wife, who was no longer there. "Where are you, and where did you ever find the nerve to cut and run, a scared little creep mouse like you?" It was this second question he cared about the most, how she had dared. The first one didn't matter all that much, not in any practical sense, because he knew where she was going to be on Saturday. A lion doesn't have to bother himself about where the zebra feeds. All he has to do is wait by the waterhole where it drinks. So far, so good, but still, how had she ever dared leave him in the first place? Even if there was no life for him beyond their final conversation, he wanted to know that. Had it been planned? An accident? An aberration born of a single impulse? Had anyone helped her? Besides, that was the late Peter Slowick in the cavalcade of cunts on Durham Avenue. What had she been doing since she'd hit the bricks of this charming little city by the lake? Waitressing? Shaking farts out of sheets in some flea bag like this? He didn't think so. She was too lazy to do menial work. You only had to look at the way she kept house to see that, and she had no skills to do anything else. If you wore tits, that left just one other choice. She was out there someplace right now, selling it on some street corner. Of course she was. What else? God knew she was a lousy lay. Screwing her had been about as exciting as fucking mud, but pussy was something men would pay for, even if it didn't do anything but lie there and drool a little after the rodeo was over. So yes, sure, she was probably out there selling it. He'd ask her about it, though. He would ask her everything. And when he had all the answers he needed, all the answers he ever wanted from the likes of her, he would wrap his belt around her neck so she couldn't scream. And then he would bite and bite and bite. His mouth and jaw still ached from what he had done to Thumper, the amazing urban Jew boy, but he wouldn't let that stop him or even slow him down. He had three Percodans at the bottom of his traveling bag, and he would take them before he went to work on his lost lamb, his sweet little rambling rose. As for afterward, after it was over, after the perks wore off, but he couldn't see that. And he didn't want to see that. He had an idea that there was going to be no after, only darkness. And that was all right. In fact, a long dose of darkness might be just what the doctor ordered. He lay in bed and drank the best scotch in the world and burned one cigarette after another, watching the smoke drift up to the ceiling in silky reefs that turned blue when they passed through the soft white radiance from the bathroom. And he trolled for her. He trolled for her, and his hook slipped through nothing but water. There was nothing there, and it was driving him crazy. It was as if she had been abducted by aliens or something. At one point, quite drunk by then, he had dropped a live cigarette into his hand and clenched his fist around it, imagining it was her hand instead of his, that he was holding his hands over hers, clamping hers tight on the heat. And as the pain bit in and wisps of smoke curled out around his knuckles, he whispered, "Where are you, Rose? Where are you hiding, you thief?" Not long after that, he drifted off. He woke up around 10 on Friday morning, unrested and hungover and vaguely frightened. He had dreamed peculiar dreams all night long. In them, he was still awake and still lying in his bed here on the 9th floor of the Whitestone, and the light from the bathroom was still cutting softly through the darkness of his room, and the cigarette smoke was still rising through it in shifting blue membranes. Only in his dreams he could see pictures like movies in the smoke. He could see Rose in the smoke. "There you are," he thought, as he watched her walk through a dead garden in a pelting rainstorm. Rose was naked for some reason, and he felt an unexpected bite of lust. He hadn't felt anything at the sight of her nakedness but weary revulsion for 8 years or more, but now she looked different. Pretty good, in fact. "It isn't that she's lost weight," he thought in the dream, "although it looks like she has. A little, anyway. Mostly it's something about the way she's moving, what she's got. What is it?" Then it came to him. She had the look of a woman who's fucking someone and hasn't had anywhere near enough just yet. If it had even crossed his mind to doubt this assessment, to say, "What, Rosie? You've got to be kidding, cousin." One look at her hair would have been enough to settle the question once and for all. She dyed it slut blonde, as if she thought she was Sharon Stone or maybe Madonna. He watched the smoke rose leave the weird dead garden and approach a stream so dark it looked more like ink than water. She crossed it on a path of stepping stones, holding her arms out for balance, and he saw that she had some sort of wet, crumpled rag in one hand. It looked like a nightgown to Norman, and he thought, "Why don't you put it on, you brazen bitch? Or are you expecting your boyfriend to come by and give your ticket a punch? I'd like to see that. I really would. Tell you one thing, if I so much as catch you holding hands with a guy when I finally track you down, the cops are going to find his goddamn trouser rat sticking out of his asshole like a birthday candle." No one came by, though. Not in the dream, anyway. The rose over his bed, the smoke rose, walked down a path through a grove of trees that looked as dead as, well, as dead as Peter Slowick. At last she came into a clearing where there was one tree which still looked alive. She knelt down, picked up a bunch of seeds, and wrapped them in what looked like another piece of her nightgown. With that done, she got up, went to a set of stairs near the tree, in dreams you never knew what fucked up thing was going to happen next, and disappeared down them. He was waiting around for her to come back up when he began to feel a presence behind him, something as cold and chill as a draft from an open meat locker. He'd handled some fairly scary people during his years as a cop. The PCP addicts he and Harley Bissington had had to deal with from time to time were probably the scariest. And you developed a sense of their presence after a while. Norman was feeling that now. Someone was coming up behind him, and he never doubted for a moment that it was someone dangerous. "I repay," a woman's voice whispered. It was a sweet voice, and soft, but it was terrifying just the same. There was no sanity in it. "Good for you, bitch," Norman said in his dream. "You try to repay me, and I'll change your whole fucking outlook." She screamed, a sound that seemed to go directly to the center of his head without even passing through his ears, and he sensed her lunging toward him with her hands out. He drew in a deep breath and blew the cigarette smoke apart. The woman disappeared. Norman felt her go. For a little while after that, there was only darkness, with him floating peacefully in the middle of it, untouched by the fears and desires which haunted him when he was awake. He woke up at 10 past 10 on Friday morning and shifted his eyes from the clock by the bed to the hotel room ceiling, almost expecting to see phantom figures moving through decaying stacks of cigarette smoke. There were no figures, of course, phantom or otherwise, no smoke for that matter, just the lingering smell of Pall Malls, in hoc signo vinces. There was only Detective Norman Daniels, lying here in a sweaty bed that smelled of tobacco and used booze. His mouth tasted as if he had spent the previous evening sucking the end of a freshly polished Cordovan shoe, and his left hand hurt like a mad bastard. He opened it and saw a shiny blister in the center of his palm. He looked at it for a long time, while pigeons fluttered and cooed at each other on the shit-encrusted ledge that ran past his window. At last, the memory of blistering himself with a cigarette came back, and he nodded. He'd done it because he couldn't see Rose no matter how hard he tried, and then, as if in compensation, he'd had crazy dreams about her all night long. He placed two fingers on the side of the blister and squeezed, slowly increasing the pressure until it popped. He wiped his hand on the sheet, relishing the waves of stinging pain. He lay looking at his hand, watching it throb almost, for a minute or so. Then he reached under his bed for his traveling bag. There was a Sucrets tin at the bottom, and in it were a dozen or so assorted pills. A few were speedy, but most were downers. As a general rule, Norman found he could get up with no pharmacological help at all. It was getting back down again that sometimes presented a problem. He took a Percodan with a small swallow of scotch, then lay back, looking up at the ceiling and once again smoking one cigarette after another, stubbing them out in the overflowing ashtray when they were done. This time it wasn't Rose he was thinking of, at least not directly. This time it was the picnic he was considering, the one being thrown by her new friends. He had been to Edinger's Pier, and what he saw there wasn't encouraging. It was large, a combination beach, picnic area, and amusement park, and he didn't see any way he could stake it out with any confidence of seeing her arrive and leave. If he'd had six men, even four if they knew what they were doing, he would have felt differently, but he was on his own. There were three ways in, assuming she didn't come by boat, and he could hardly watch all three of them at the same time. That meant working the crowd, and working the crowd would be a bitch kitty. He wished he could believe that Rose would be the only one there tomorrow who would recognize him, but if wishes were pigs, bacon would always be on sale. He had to assume they would be looking for him, and he would also have to assume they had received pictures of him from one of their sister groups back home. He didn't know about the X, but he was coming to believe that the first two letters in fact stood for fucked again. That was one part of the problem. The other part was his own belief, backstopped by more than one bitter experience, that disguises were a recipe for disaster in situations like this. The only quicker, surer route to failure in the field was probably wearing the ever-popular wire, where you can lose 6 months' worth of surveillance and setup if a kid happened to be running a radio-controlled boat or race car in the area where you were planning to bring the hammer down on some shitbag. All right, he thought. Don't bitch about it. Remember what old Whitey Slater used to say, the situation is what the situation is. How you're going to work around it is the only question, and don't even think of putting it off. Their goddamn party is just 24 hours away, and if you miss her there, you could hunt for her until Christmas and not find her. In case you hadn't noticed, this is a big city. He got up, walked into the bathroom, and showered with his blistered hands stuck out through the shower curtain. He dressed in faded jeans and a nondescript green shirt, putting on his Chi Sox cap and tucking the cheap sunglasses into his shirt pocket, at least for the time being. He took the elevator down to the lobby and went to the newsstand to get a paper and a box of Band-Aids. While he was waiting for the dope behind the counter to figure out his change, he looked over the guy's shoulder and through a glass panel at the back of the newsstand alcove. He could see the service elevators through this panel, and as he watched, one of them opened. Three chattering, laughing chambermaids stepped out. They were carrying their purses, and Norman guessed they were on their way to lunch. He had seen the one in the middle, slim, pretty, fluffy blonde hair, someplace else. After a moment, it came to him. He had been on his way to check out daughters and sisters. The blonde had walked beside him for a little while. Red slacks, cute little ass. "Here you are, sir," the counterman said. Norman stuffed his change into his pocket without looking at it. Nor did he look at the trio of maids as he shouldered past them, not even at the one with the cute tush. He had cross-referenced her automatically, that was all. It was a cop reflex, a knee that jerked on its own. His conscious mind was fixed on one thing and one thing only, the best way to spot Rose tomorrow, without being spotted himself. He was heading up the corridor toward the doors when he heard two words which he at first thought must have come out of his own head. Edinger's Pier. His stride faltered, his heart kicked into overdrive, and the blister in the palm of his hand began to throb fiercely. It was a single misstep, that was all, that one little hesitation, and then he went on heading toward the revolving doors with his head down. Someone looking at him might have thought he'd felt a brief muscle twinge in his knee or calf, no more than that, and that was good. He didn't dare falter. That was the hell of it. If the woman who'd spoken was one of the cunts from their clubhouse over on Durham Avenue, she might recognize him if he drew attention to himself, might have already recognized him, if the speaker of those two magic words was the little honey he'd crossed the street beside the other day. He knew it was unlikely. As a cop, he'd had first-hand experience of how amazingly, numbingly unobservant most civilians were. But from time to time, it did happen. Killers and kidnappers and bank thieves, who had eluded capture long enough to make the FBI's 10 most wanted list, suddenly found themselves back in the slam, dropped by a 7-Eleven clerk who read True Detective, or a meter maid who watched all the reality crime shows on TV. He didn't dare stop, but he had to stop. Norman knelt abruptly to the left of the swinging door with his back to the women. He dropped his head and pretended to tie his shoe. "Sorry to miss the concert, but if I want that car, I can't pass up the..." Out the door they went, but what Norman had heard convinced him. It was the picnic the woman was talking about, the picnic and the concert that was going to round off the day, some group called the Indian Girls, probably Lezzies. So there was a chance that this woman knew Rosie. Not a good chance. Lots of people who weren't tight with daughters and sisters would be at Ettinger's Pier tomorrow, but a chance just the same. And Norman was a man who believed emphatically in the fickle finger of fate. The hell of it was, he did not yet know which of the three had been talking. "Let it be Blondie," he prayed as he got quickly to his feet and went out through the swinging door. "Let it be Blondie with the big eyes and the cute ass. Let it be her, what do you say?" It was dangerous to follow, of course. You could never tell when one of them might glance idly around and win the super bonus round of place the face. But at this point, he could do nothing else. He sauntered along behind them, his head casually turned to one side as if the junkola in the shop windows he was passing was of vital interest to him. "How are you making out on pillowcases today?" the tub of guts walking on the inside asked the other two. "For once they're all there," the older woman walking on the outside said. "How about you, Pam?" "I haven't counted yet. It's too depressing," Blondie replied, and they all laughed, those high, giggly sounds that always made Norman feel as if his fillings were cracking in his mouth. He stopped at once, looking in a window at a bunch of sporting goods, letting the maids pull ahead. It was her, all right, no question about it. Blondie was the one who had said the magic words, Ettinger's Pier. Maybe it changed everything, maybe it changed nothing. Right now, he was too excited to figure it out. It was certainly an amazing stroke of luck, though, the kind of miraculous, coincidental break you always hoped for when you were working a long-shot case, the break that happened more often than anyone would ever believe. For now, he would file this in the back of his mind and proceed with Plan A. He wouldn't even ask about Blondie back at the hotel, at least not yet. He knew her name was Pam, and that was plenty to start with. Norman walked to the bus stop, waited 15 minutes for the airport shuttle, and then hopped on board. It was a long ride. The terminal was on the edge of the city. When he finally disembarked in front of Terminal A, he slipped on his dark glasses, crossed the street, and made his way to the long-term parking area. The first car he tried jumping had been there so long the battery was dead. The second one, a nondescript Ford Tempo, started all right. He told the man in the collection booth that he had been in Dallas for 3 weeks and had lost his ticket. He was always losing them, he said. He lost laundry tickets, too, and he was always having to show his driver's license at Photomat when he stopped in to pick up his snapshots. The man in the collection booth nodded and nodded the way you do at a boring story you've already heard about 10,000 times. When Norman humbly offered him an extra $10 in lieu of the ticket, the man in the collection booth perked up a little. The money disappeared. Norman Daniels drove out of long-term parking at almost exactly the same moment that Robbie Lefferts was offering his fugitive wife what he termed a more solid business arrangement. 2 miles down the road, Norman parked behind a beat-to-shit Le Sabre and swapped license plates. Another 2 miles on, he stopped at a robo-wash. He had a bet with himself that the Tempo would turn out to be dark blue, but he lost. It was green. He didn't think it mattered. The man in the collection booth had only taken his eyes off his little black-and-white TV when the 10-spot had appeared under his nose, but it was best to play safe. It increased the comfort level. Norman turned on the radio and found an oldie station. Shirley Ellis was on, and he sang along as Shirley instructed, "If the first two letters are ever the same, drop them both and say the name like Barry, Barry, drop the B-O-Ary. That's the only rule that is contrary." Norman realized he knew every word of that stupid old song. What kind of world was it, where you couldn't remember the fucking quadratic equation or the various forms of the French verb avoir 2 years after you got out of high school, but when you were getting on for 40 years old, you could still remember nick-nick bobic, banana-fana-fofic, fee-fi-momic, nick? What kind of world was that? "One that's slipping behind me now," Norman thought serenely, and yes, that seemed to be the truth. It was like in those science fiction movies where the spacemen saw Earth dwindling in the view screens, first a ball, then a coin, then a tiny glowing dot, then all gone. That was what the inside of his head was like now, a spacecraft headed out on a 5-year mission to explore new worlds and go where no man had gone before, the starship Norman approaching warp speed. Shirley Ellis finished up and something by the Beatles came on. Norman twisted the radio's volume knob off so hard he broke it. He didn't want to listen to any of that hippy-dippy Hey Jude crap today. He was still a couple of miles from where the real city began when he saw a place called the Base Camp. Army surplus like you never find, the sign out front read, and for some reason that made him burst out laughing. He thought it was in some ways the single most peculiar motto he'd seen in his whole life. It seemed to mean something, but it was impossible to say just what. Anyway, the sign didn't matter. The store probably had one of the things he was looking for, and that did. There was a big banner reading, "Always be safe, never be sorry," over the middle aisle. Norman inspected 3 different kinds of stun gas, pepper gas pellets, a rack of ninja throwing stars, the perfect weapon for home defense if you should happen to be attacked by a blind quadriplegic, gas guns that fired rubber bullets, slingshots, brass knuckles, both plain and studded, blackjacks and bolas, whips and whistles. Halfway down this aisle was a glass case containing what Norman considered to be the only really useful item in the base camp. For $63.50, he purchased a taser, which produced a large, although probably not the 90,000 volts promised on the label, wallop of juice between its 2 steel poles when the triggers were pushed. Norman considered this weapon every bit as dangerous as a small caliber pistol, and the best part was that one did not have to sign one's name anywhere in order to purchase one. "You want a 9-volt battery with that?" the clerk asked. He was a bullet-headed young man with a hair lip. He wore a T-shirt which said, "Better to have a gun and not need one than need one and not have one." To Norman, he looked like the sort of fellow whose parents might have been blood relatives. "That's what it runs on, a 9-volt." Norman realized what the young man with the hair lip was trying to say and nodded. "Give me 2, he said. "Let's live a little." The young man laughed as if this was the funniest line he'd ever heard, even funnier than "army surplus like you never find." And then he bent down, got 2 9-volt batteries from under the counter, and slapped them down beside Norman's Amiga taser. "Dull feature," the young man cried, and laughed some more. Norman figured this one out, too, after a moment, and laughed right along with young Mr. Hairlip, and later he thought that was the exact moment when he hit warp speed and all the stars turned into lines. "All ahead, Mr. Sulu. This time we're going way past the Klingon Empire." He drove the stolen Tempo back into the city, and in a part of town where the smiling models on the cigarette billboard started being black rather than white, he found a barber shop by the charming name of Cut Me Some Slack. He went in and found a young black man with a cool mustache sitting in an old-fashioned barber chair. There were Walkman earphones on his head and a copy of Jet in his lap. "What you want?" the black barber asked. He spoke perhaps more brusquely than he would have to a black man, but not discourteously either. You weren't discourteous to a man like this without a damn good reason, especially when you were alone in your shop. He was 6'2" at least, with broad shoulders and big, thick legs. Also, he smelled like a cop. Above the mirror were photographs of Michael Jordan, Charles Barkley, and Jalen Rose. Jordan was wearing a Birmingham Barons baseball uniform. Above his picture was a slip of paper with "The Once and Future Bull" typed on it. Norman pointed. "Do me like that," he said. The black barber looked at Norman carefully, first making sure he wasn't drunk or stoned, then trying to make sure he wasn't joking. The second was harder than the first. "What you saying, brother? Are you saying you want a clean head?" "That's exactly what I'm saying." Norman ran a hand through his hair, which was a thick black just starting to show flecks of gray at the temples. It was neither exceptionally short nor exceptionally long. He had worn it at this same length for almost 20 years. He looked at himself in the mirror, trying to imagine what he was going to look like, as bald as Michael Jordan, only white. He couldn't do it. With luck, Rose and her new friends wouldn't be able to either. "You sure?" Suddenly, Norman felt almost sick with the desire to knock this man down and drop both knees onto his chest and lean over and bite his entire upper lip, cool mustache and all, right off his face. He supposed he knew why, too. He looked like that memorable little cocksucker Ramon Sanders, the one who had tried to cash in on the ATM card his lying bitch of a wife had stolen. "Oh, barber," Norman thought. Oh, Barbara, you're so close to being nothing but taillights. Ask one more question. Say one more wrong word in my face, and that's all you'll be. And I can't say anything to you. I couldn't warn you, even if I wanted to, because right now, my own voice is all the firing pin I'd need. So here we are, and here we go. The barber gave him another long, careful look. Norman stood where he was and let him do it. Now he felt composed. What happened would be what happened. It was all in this jiggity-jig's hands. All right, I guess you are, the barber said at last. His voice was mild and disarming. Norman relaxed his right hand, which had been shoved deep into his pocket and gripping the handle of the taser. The barber put his magazine on the counter beside his bottles of tonic and cologne. There was a little brass sign there that said Samuel Lowe. Then got up and shook out a plastic apron. You won't be like Mike? Let's do it. 20 minutes later, Norman was staring at himself thoughtfully in the mirror. Samuel Lowe stood beside his chair, watching him look. Lowe seemed apprehensive, but he also seemed interested. He looked like a man seeing something familiar from an entirely new perspective. Two new customers had come in. They were also looking at Norman, look at himself, and they wore identical expressions of appraisal. The man be handsome, one of the newcomers said. He spoke in a tone of faint surprise, and mostly to himself. Norman couldn't get entirely straight in his mind the fact that the man in the mirror was still him. He winked and the mirror man winked. He smiled and the mirror man smiled. He turned and the mirror man turned, but it didn't help. Before, he'd had the brow of a cop. Now he had the brow of a mathematics professor, a brow that went into the stratosphere. He couldn't get over the smooth, somehow sensuous curves of his bald skull and its whiteness. He hadn't thought he had anything like a tan, but compared to his pallid skull, the rest of his skin was as brown as a lifeguard's. His head looked strangely fragile and too weirdly perfect to belong to the likes of him, to belong to any human being, especially a male. It looked like a piece of Delft china. You ain't got a bad head at all, man, Lowe said. He spoke tentatively, but Norman had no sense he was trying to flatter him, and that was good, because Norman was in no mood to have someone blow smoke up his ass. Look good. Look younger, don't he, Dale? Ain't bad, the other newcomer agreed. No, sir. Not half. How much did you say? Norman asked Samuel Lowe. He tried to turn away from the mirror and was distressed and a little frightened to find that his eyes tried to follow the top of his head to see how it looked in the back. That sense of disassociation was stronger within him than ever. He wasn't the man in the mirror, the man with a scholar's bald head rising above heavy black eyebrows. How could he be? This was some stranger, that was all, some fantastic Lex Luthor up to no good in Metropolis. And the things he did from here on out didn't matter. From here on out, nothing mattered, except catching Rose, of course, and talking to her. Up close. Lowe was giving him that cautious look again, breaking it off to dart glances at the other two patrons, and Norman suddenly realized he was checking to see if they'd help him, if the big white man, the big bald white man, suddenly went berserk. I'm sorry, he said, trying to make his voice soft and conciliatory. You were talking, weren't you? What did you say? I said, 30 sounds about right to me. How's it sound to you? Norman took a folded-over packet of bills out of his left front pocket, slid 2 20s out from under the tarnished old money clip, and held them out. 30 sounds too low, he said. Take 40 along with my apologies. You did a great job. I've just had a bitch of a week, that's all. You don't know the half of it, buddy, he thought. Samuel Lowe relaxed visibly and took the money. No prob, bro, he said, and I wasn't kidding. You ain't got a bad-looking head at all. You ain't Michael, but ain't nobody Michael. Except Michael, the newcomer named Dale said. The three black men laughed heartily and nodded at one another. Although he could have killed all three of them without turning a hair, Norman nodded and laughed along with them. The newcomers in the barber shop had changed things. It was time to be careful again. Still laughing, he went out. A trio of teenagers, also black, were leaning against a fence near the tempo, but they hadn't bothered doing anything to the car, possibly because it was too much of a dog to bother with. They eyed Norman's pallid white head with interest, then glanced at each other and rolled their eyes. They were 14 or so, boys without much trouble in them. The one in the middle started to say, "You looking at me?" like Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver. Norman seemed to sense this and stared at him, just at him, it seemed, ignoring the other two completely. The one in the middle decided that maybe his De Niro imitation needed a little more work and quit it. Norman got into his freshly washed stolen car and drove away. 6 blocks in toward the center of the city, he went into a used clothing store called Play It Again, Sam. There were several browsers in the store, and they all looked at him, but that was okay. Norman didn't mind being looked at, especially if it was his freshly shaven skull they were paying attention to. If they were looking at the top of his head, they wouldn't have the slightest fucking idea what his face looked like 5 minutes after he left. He found a motorcycle jacket that gleamed with studs and zippers and small silver chains and creaked in every fold when he took it off its hanger. The clerk opened his mouth to ask $240 for the jacket, looked at the haunted eyes peering out from beneath the awesome white desert of that freshly shaven skull, and told Norman the jacket was $180 plus tax. He would have gone lower had Norman dickered, but Norman didn't. He was tired now, his head was throbbing, and he wanted to go back to the hotel and go to sleep. He wanted to sleep right through until tomorrow. He needed all the rest he could get, because tomorrow was going to be a busy day. He made 2 more stops on the way back. The first was at a store which sold ostomy supplies. Here Norman bought a motorless second-hand wheelchair which would fit, folded up, into the trunk of the Tempo. Then he went to the Women's Cultural Center and Museum. Here he paid $6 to get in, but looked at no exhibits, and did not so much as peer into the auditorium, where a panel discussion on natural childbirth was being held. He made a quick trip to the gift shop, then left. Back at the Whitestone, he went upstairs without asking anyone about Blondie with a cute little ass. He would not have trusted himself to ask for a glass of club soda in his current condition. His newly shaven head was pounding like a steel forge. His eyes were beating in their sockets. His teeth hurt, and his jaws throbbed. Worst of all, his mind now seemed to be bobbing along above him like a float in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade. It felt as if it were tethered to the rest of him by a single fragile thread and might break away at any moment. He had to lie down, to sleep. Maybe then his mind would go back inside his head where it belonged. As for Blondie, his best course would be to treat her as an ace in the hole, something to be used only if absolutely necessary, break glass in case of emergency. Norman went back to bed at 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon. The throbbing behind his temples was no longer anything resembling a hangover. It was now one of the headaches he called his specials. He got them frequently when he was working hard, and since Rose had left and his big drug case had heated up, 2 a week weren't unusual. As he lay in bed, looking up at the ceiling, his eyes ran and his nose leaked, and he could see funny, bright zigzag patterns pulsing around the edges of things. The pain had reached the point where it felt like there was some horrible fetus in the middle of his head trying to be born, the point where there was nothing to do but hunker down and wait for it to be over. And the way you did that was by getting through the moments one at a time, going from one to the next, the way a person might use stepping stones to cross a stream. That tugged some hazy memory far back in his mind, but it couldn't get past the relentless throbbing, and Norman let it go. He rubbed his hand back and forth across the top of his head. The smoothness up there felt like nothing that could be a part of him. It was like touching the hood of a freshly waxed car. "Who am I?" he asked the empty room. "Who am I? Why am I here? What am I doing? Who am I?" Before he could stab at an answer to any of these questions, he fell asleep. The pain followed him for quite a distance into its dreamless depths, like a bad idea that won't let go. But finally Norman left it behind. His head sagged to one side on his pillow, and a wetness which was not precisely tears ran out of his left eye and left nostril and trickled down his cheek. He began to snore thickly. When he woke up 12 hours later at 4 o'clock on Saturday morning, his headache was gone. He felt fresh and energized, as he almost always did after one of his specials. He sat up, put his feet on the floor, and looked out the window at darkness. The pigeons were out there on the ledge, cooing to each other even in their sleep. He knew, completely and surely and without any doubt, that this day was going to see the end of it. Probably the end of him as well, but that was a minor matter. Just knowing there would be no more headaches, not ever, made that seem like a fair trade. Across the room, his new motorcycle jacket hung over a chair like a black and headless ghost. Wake up early, Rose, he thought, almost tenderly. Wake up early, Honey Bunch, and get a good look at the sunrise, why don't you? You ought to get the best look you can, because it's the last one you're ever going to see.
Rosie woke at a few minutes past four on Saturday morning and fumbled for the lamp by the bed, terrified, sure that Norman was in the room with her, sure she could smell his cologne. All my men wear English leather, or they wear nothing at all. She almost knocked the lamp onto the floor in her panicky efforts to make a light, but when it was finally on, with the base hanging halfway over oblivion, her fear subsided quickly. It was just her room, small and neat and sane, and the only thing she could smell was the faint, bedwarm fragrance of her own skin. No one was here but her. And Rose Madder, of course. But Rose Madder was safely put away in the closet, where she undoubtedly still stood with one hand raised to shade her eyes, looking down at the ruins of the temple. I was dreaming about him, she thought as she sat up. I was having another nightmare about Norman, that's why I woke up so scared. She pushed the lamp back on the table. It clinked against the armlet. Rose picked it up and looked at it. Strange how hard it was to remember, what you have to remember, how she'd come by this trinket. Had she bought it in Bill's shop, because it looked like the one the woman in her picture was wearing? She didn't know, and that was troubling. How could you forget what you need to forget, a thing like that? Rosie lifted the circlet, which felt as heavy as gold but was probably just gilded pot metal, and looked across the room through it, like a woman looking through a telescope. As she did, a fragment of her dream came back, and she realized it hadn't been about Norman at all. It had been about Bill. They had been on his motorcycle, but instead of taking her to a picnic place by the lake, he had driven her down a path that wound deeper and deeper into a sinister forest of dead leaves. After a while, they came into a clearing, and in the clearing was a single live tree, laden with fruit the color of Rose Madder's chiton. Oh, what a great first course, Bill had cried cheerfully, hopping off his motorcycle and hurrying toward the tree. I've heard about these. Eat one, and you can see out of the back of your head. Eat two, and you live forever. That was where the dream had crossed the line from the merely unsettling into real nightmare country. She knew somehow that the fruit of that tree wasn't magic, but horribly poisonous, and she ran to him, wanting to stop him before he could bite into one of the tempting fruits. But Bill wouldn't be convinced. He merely put an arm around her, gave her a little hug, and said, "Don't be silly, Rosie. I know pomegranates, and these aren't them." That was when she'd awakened, shivering madly in the dark and thinking not about Bill, but about Norman. As if Norman were lying in bed someplace near and thinking about her. This idea made Rosie cross her arms over her breasts and hug herself. It was all too possible that he was doing just that. She put the armlet back down on the table, hurried into the bathroom, and turned on the shower. Her troubling dream of Bill and the poisoned fruit, her questions about where or how she might have come by the armlet, and her confused feelings about the picture she'd bought, then unframed, then hidden away in the closet like a secret. All these things faded behind a larger and more immediate concern, her date. It was today, and every time she thought of that, she felt something like a hot wire in her chest. She was both afraid and happy, but more than anything else, she was curious. Her date. Their date. If he even comes, a voice inside whispered ominously. It could have all been a joke, you know. Or you might have scared him off. Rosie started to step into the water and realized just in the nick of time that she was still wearing her panties. He'll come, she murmured as she bent and slipped them off. He'll come all right. I know he will. As she ducked under the spray and reached for the shampoo, a voice far back in her mind, a very different voice this time, whispered, "Beasts will fight." What? Rosie froze with the plastic bottle in one hand. She was frightened, and she didn't quite know why. What did you say?
Nothing.
She couldn't even remember exactly what it was that she'd thought, only that it was something else about that damned picture, which had gotten into her head like the chorus of a song you can't forget. As she began to lather her hair, Rosie decided abruptly to get rid of it. The thought of doing that made her feel better, like the thought of quitting some bad habit, smoking, drinking at lunch, and by the time she stepped out of the shower, she was humming. Bill didn't torture her with doubt by being late. Rosie had pulled one of the kitchen chairs over by the window so she could watch for him. At 7:15, she had done this 3 full hours after she'd stepped out of the shower. And at 8:25, a motorcycle with a cooler strapped to the carrier rack pulled into one of the spaces in front of the building. The driver's head was covered by a big blue helmet, and the angle was wrong for her to see his face. But she knew it was him. Already the line of his shoulders was unmistakable to her. He gunned the engine once, then killed it, and used a booted heel to drop the Harley's kickstand. He swung one leg off, and for a moment the line of his thigh was clearly visible against his faded jeans. Rosie felt a tremor of timid but unmistakable lust go through her, and thought, "That's what I'll be thinking about tonight while I'm waiting to go to sleep. That's what I'm going to see. And if I'm very, very lucky, it's what I'll dream about." She thought of waiting for him up here, of letting him come to her the way a girl who is comfortable in the home of her parents might wait for the boy who is going to take her to the homecoming dance, waiting even after he has come, watching in her strapless party dress from behind the curtain of her bedroom window, smiling a small secret smile as he gets out of his father's newly washed and waxed car and comes to the door, self-consciously adjusting his bow tie or tugging on his cummerbund. She thought of it, then opened the closet door, reached in, and snatched out her sweater. She hurried down the hall, slipping into it as she went. It crossed her mind as she came to the head of the stairs and saw him already halfway up, his head raised to look at her, that she had reached the perfect age, too old to be coy for the sake of coyness, but still too young not to believe that some hopes, the ones that really matter, may turn out, against all odds, to be justified. "Hi," she said, looking down from her place. "You're on time." "Sure," he said, looking up from his. He seemed faintly surprised. "I'm always on time. It's the way I was raised. I think it might have been bred in my genes, too." He held one gloved hand up to her, like a cavalier in a movie. He smiled. "Are you ready?" This was a question she didn't yet know how to answer, so she just met him where he was, and took his hand, and let him lead her down and out into the sunlight, washing over the first Saturday of June. He stood her on the curb beside the leaning bike, looked her critically up and down, then shook his head. "Nope, nope, the sweater doesn't make it," he said. "Luckily, my Boy Scout training has never deserted me." There were saddlebags on either side of the Harley's carrier rack. He unbuckled one of them and pulled out a leather jacket similar to his own. Zipper pockets high and low on either side, but otherwise black and plain. No studs, epaulettes, lightning bolts, or gewgaws. It was smaller than the one Bill wore. She looked at it hanging flat in his hands like a pelt, troubled by the obvious question. He saw the look, understood it at once, and shook his head. "It's my dad's jacket. He taught me to ride on an old Indian hammerhead he took in trade for a dining room table and a bedroom set. The year he turned 21, he rode that bike all over America," he says. "It was the kind you had to kickstart, and if you forgot to put the gear shift in neutral, it was apt to go tearing right out from under you." "What happened? Did he crash it?" She smiled a little. "Did you crash it?" "Neither one. It died of old age. Since then, they've all been Harleys in the Steiner family. This is a Heritage Softail, 1345cc. He touched the nacelle gently. "Dad hasn't ridden for 5 years or so now."
"Did he get tired of it?"
Bill shook his head. "Nope, he got glaucoma." She slipped into the jacket. She guessed that Bill's father must be at least 3 inches shorter and maybe 40 pounds lighter than his son. But the jacket still hung comically on her, almost to her knees. It was warm, though,
and she zipped it up to her chin with a kind of sensuous pleasure. "You look good," he said. "Kind of funny, like a kid playing dress-up, but good. Really,